Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Next Tuesday, California will move into another phase of the pandemic, which is kind of a return. The state is lifting the universal mask mandate it put in place 2 months ago during the holiday season. And it might feel like deja vu, because for about 6 months last year, when the state lifted the stay-at-home order, so went a statewide mask mandate. During that period, the decision on masking for those vaccinated was left in the hands of local jurisdictions and businesses. So depending on where you live, you could go to one county indoors maskless and a neighboring county where one was required. And of course, consistent with a pandemic where there are few, if any, simple answers, masking was still required in certain scenarios like schools, healthcare, and long-term care facilities, public transit, detention centers, and shelters. So on Tuesday, masks once again come off, but not everywhere and technically not for everyone. Those unvaccinated will still have to wear a mask, but having lived through the pandemic for as long as we all have, we know that enforcing that is very difficult. And although dozens of counties are expected to follow the state's lead next week, including Sacramento, Yolo, and San Francisco counties, Los Angeles is still keeping its mandate in place. As of yesterday, California's test positivity rate for COVID-19 has dropped to 8.7%. That's down from 22% exactly 1 month ago. So with that maze of a mouthful out of the way, joining us to discuss the decision-making in Sacramento County is Public Health Officer Dr. Olivia Cassirier. Dr. Cassirier, welcome back to Insight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, looking at your county, Dr. Cassirier, just bring us up to date and up to speed on how Sacramento County is faring.
So we hit a peak of 240 cases per 100,000 in early January. And after that, the numbers started going down pretty rapidly. And of the last update that we got, we're at about 62 per 100,000 case rate. And so looking at that and also seeing that with the Omicron variant, although it's very contagious, it does tend to be less severe, especially for people that are vaccinated. When the state made the announcement that they were not going to renew the universal masking mandate, we made the decision that we will follow the state's lead.
Why are you comfortable in following the state's lead and ending the mask mandate for Sacramento?
Well, it's a balance that we have to reach as we are looking at how we move forward. And especially as we are coming off of this Omicron variant, of course, questions are coming up as to what's the next step, where are we going, how are we going to start releasing some of the restrictions that we have had, and at the same time still provide the maximum protection for those that are most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So that is why with this restrictions in masking, it doesn't go away completely. It does go away for people that are vaccinated, but we know that it can be a very severe disease for people that are not vaccinated. And also it can be very severe for people that have chronic conditions like diabetes, hypertension. So we need to be able to continue protecting them.
Yeah, for those who aren't comfortable taking off their mask or who are immunocompromised, what advice do you have for them as they navigate, a different phase in this pandemic next week in the county?
We certainly continue to recommend masking, especially for people that have conditions that put them at risk. And then also, of course, we know that the vaccines that we have are very effective. So we continue to encourage everybody to get vaccinated and boosted if they're eligible.
Is this essentially, when we're talking about this next phase, allowing individuals to make their own risk assessments in what they're comfortable of being exposed to, given that vaccines are widely available and every person's health is very individualized and it's hard. I don't know. I guess it's just allowing people to make decisions for themselves and assess the risk on their own.
That's true, Vicky. And as I've mentioned again with public health, we have to get to that balance of what kind of restrictions we are going to put on the entire community as a whole to protect everybody. And also at the same time, being able to allow people to make those choices. So now that we have the vaccine very readily available, we're at that point, for example, with the large events this time around, we did not shut those down. And those are some of the questions that we were asked about. And the answer was that this time around, we have vaccines and people can make that choice whether they want to go to those events or not. So it's something that you're going to see a lot of as we get into this post-Omicron phase of seeing what restrictions are going to be lifted and where people actually have to start making their own decisions and risk assessments.
Do county public health officers like yourself have conversations or coordinate or even consult other counties and surrounding counties in making these decisions, especially neighboring counties like Yolo, Placer, or El Dorado County? Or
absolutely.
San Joaquin, actually.
Absolutely. And actually, right from the start of this pandemic, one of the things that has really helped us as we are navigating all of these different changes that the COVID-19 is throwing at us is being able to speak with our fellow health officers. So we have a regional health officer group in the Sacramento region, and we meet very frequently. We communicate very frequently as well, and it helps a lot in making some of these decisions.
What are you hearing from counties like maybe Los Angeles and others as to their reasoning for keeping the mask mandate in place?
I believe that Los Angeles did provide some of the criteria that they are looking at. And of course, every county is unique. And so every health officer ultimately has to look at their own community and make some of those decisions. But definitely being able to share information and the decision making, it really helps.
We've been accustomed to the unknown and unpredictability. What concerns you about lifting this mandate?
I think one of the challenges is making sure that, one, people do recognize that COVID-19 is still with us and it can still be a very severe disease. And the fact that we are loosening some of these restrictions does not mean that it has completely gone away. So people still need to make some of those risk assessments. The other is to make sure that people do recognize that masks are very effective and that our doing this does not mean that we have less confidence in the way the masks work, but it's just that the recognition that for people that are vaccinated, they can actually make that choice to go into certain public places without a mask.
Should we all be prepared for the possibility that this mandate and masking would be reimposed?
Well, we hope not, but that is one thing that we have to be prepared for in terms of monitoring what is going on with the numbers. So, of course, we are looking at that very closely. Our hope is that as we get through this and as more people get vaccinated, that we will be able to get past this surge and that people will be able to start looking at getting back to normal.
I want to get back to masking because enforcement is going to be tough, if not impossible. I mean, we're relying in most part on an honor system. And quite frankly, a lot of people are just done with it all. So what is your message to those who are unvaccinated, who maybe just be tired of wearing masks, and to those who are charged with enforcing the county's rules or recommendations as of next Tuesday?
I think the reminder is that we are fighting an enemy that is invisible, but is also very persistent. And we have seen that with the surges. And so we can't let our guard down. We are, of course, leaving it up to the individual to self-attest to whether they're vaccinated or not when they're going into certain public places and therefore choosing to wear a mask or not. But it's very important to know that this is for the protection of your loved ones. It's for your own protection because we know masks are effective. And if you need to wear one, you should be comfortable doing that.
What is the pace of the vaccination rate and including boosters in Sacramento County?
Well, the vaccinations, we continue to do vaccinations, especially for the underserved communities. Right now, we are not doing any of the large events anymore. It's more of the pop-up clinics in neighborhoods, because one of the things that we realize and recognize is that especially for some of the underserved communities, we have to take the services to them and we have to work with people that they already trust. So doing that, the method that we have found that is most effective is being able to work with community-based agencies. So we have up to sometimes 60 clinics planned within a week, but all of them are very small. But every single one that we get vaccinated counts. So we're going to continue doing that.
Yeah. When talking about the latest surge that we all went through, I mean, obviously so many people tested positive. How did hospitals in Sacramento handle it?
The hospitals worked really hard. They were very full, and at times we were concerned about capacity. But they have been communicating with each other in terms of being able to make sure that they're able to take care of the patients that come in. And the state has also assisted by providing additional staffing for extra beds. So at this point, we are seeing the numbers starting to decline, but we are not out of the woods yet. So of course, we still put the message out to people. If you don't have a condition that is life-threatening or requires emergency room, please don't go to the emergency room.
What did you learn about this recent Omicron wave?
I think the biggest message is that this virus is very persistent and it can change, because we had just come off of the Delta surge and we thought that we were actually on a good footing, and then came a new variant. So we have to continue with the measures that we know are effective, and we have to continue communicating to the public, to tell them what the risk is, to tell them where we're going with the plans, and to be able to be there to provide the assistance for those that need it. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento County Public Health Officer Dr. Olivia Cassirier about lifting the mask mandate in California next week, which Sacramento County is following. I got to get to a huge issue for so many people that remains when it comes to the mandate for children to wear masks in schools. This is not part of the easing of the statewide mandate next week, but should it be, in your opinion?
Understandably, some parents have been contacting us and telling us that they're very anxious and would like to end it in the schools as well. But I think one thing that people need to realize is that COVID-19 does impact children as well. We have seen, especially after the opening of the schools this year, that we've seen more cases in the hospital of children. And so it's important for parents to recognize that this is also the group that is least vaccinated. I think in Sacramento County, our vaccination rate for school-age children is about 35% or so. So we still have work to do, and we still need to protect those that are most vulnerable, because some of the children do have conditions that put them at risk, but they still want to be able to go to school. So it's something that we, of course, are discussing what the next steps will be. But I think what we can ask parents to do is just to be patient, and we will get there. But we want to make sure that we provide protection for everybody.
How do you navigate, and what do you think about the mental health toll over the last 2 years with children?
I think it's important for us to make sure that we provide that support. It's been very difficult for children with the isolation, with the changes, and because like last year when the schools were opening up, they had to have the social distancing. So very important for us to provide that support, and we are working with school officials to be able to find ways of providing additional staff that would be able to provide that mental health support to the students.
Yeah. Next week, the governor is expected to announce some possible changes to mask mandates in schools, and it may be a slow or phased rollout, but several other states have already moved on from their mask requirements for children. What conversations are taking place within Sacramento County about how schools within the county can move forward with lifting mask mandates in schools?
Well, we're waiting to see what the governor's office comes up with. I know that there have been a lot of discussions in terms of how this is going to roll out, so we don't have all the details. Definitely, we want to be able to support the schools and the school officials. But once we know what the details are, then we'll be able to work with them on that.
Are you being consulted by the state on your views for masks in schools? I mean, do you work? I know you talked about talking with surrounding counties, but do you talk with the state public health department?
Oh, yes, we do talk with the state public health department as well.
Senator Richard Pan has introduced a bill in the legislature. It's going to remove the exceptions for public school children in California and require them to get the COVID-19 vaccine. You mentioned in Sacramento County, roughly about a third of children are vaccinated. As a public health official, are you supportive of this bill?
Well, we're certainly supportive of any measures that provide protection for children. I don't know how it's going to, this aspect, particular legislation is going to make it through, but definitely we will be there to provide vaccinations for children that need it.
Yeah. There has been a lot of talk about this word endemic, or essentially living with this virus for the long term. We just had a segment yesterday about how, you know, endemic is kind of meaningless because it can mean so many things. I mean, do you view COVID-19 as an endemic, and how do you view it, and how do we prepare for it? And I guess, what does that mean from a public health perspective?
Well, COVID-19 is still very new to all of us, and so we're still learning more about it. There have been discussions about what does an endemic look like, and at this point, we really don't know, because we don't know if the Omicron is going to be the last variant, at least for a while, and therefore that the numbers will remain about the same. But I think what's most important for us is to make sure that we are continuing to monitor and provide recommendations, advice to the public about what we're seeing and what they need to do to protect themselves. So the basic answer is, at this point, we really don't know. I think the virus will dictate to us when we get to that point.
Yeah, I think we are getting used to, I don't know. We're about more than 2 years into it. Dr. Kasirye, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you, Ricky.
And that is Sacramento County Public Health Officer, Dr. Olivia Kasirye. Up next, say goodbye to Humboldt State and hello to Cal Poly Humboldt. The university joins us about what went into this change in designation and how this will impact the North Coast. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. After nearly 50 years, Humboldt State University is no more. The campus remains, but the name is different. Now, Cal Poly Humboldt is becoming the third polytechnic university in the California State University System. The designation's focus centers on programs emphasizing STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and math. Cal Poly Humboldt hopes this will transform the campus and pay dividends to surrounding North Coast communities. The change was hailed by Governor Gavin Newsom as a key investment in meeting California's workforce needs in the 21st century. But the name change is really only the beginning. The university has set ambitious enrollment goals while promising to build new facilities and ensuring this becomes an economic catalyst for the region. Here to discuss the big change and how the university plans to meet the challenges ahead is Cal Poly Humboldt's Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs, Dr. Jen Capps. Dr. Capps, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Cal Poly Humboldt is in an effort 2 years really in the making. Walk us through how and why the university became the newest polytechnic university in the state.
Yeah, you bet. So it's really an acknowledgement of the excellence that already existed here at now Cal Poly Humboldt. Excellent facilities, wonderful faculty, Great science programs. The location is phenomenal. It's where the forest meets the ocean. And so it was really a recognition that we were nearly a polytechnic already without the designation, but folks were having a little bit of a difficult time finding us and recognizing us as that. So through a partnership with our system office and a recognition that we had some capacity to grow, we partnered with our system office to create a plan to be able to shift to this polytechnic. And really what that meant was adding some additional programs in applied science, technology, and engineering.
Cal Poly Humboldt is one of 23 campuses within CSU. What's unique about the Humboldt student community?
The location is absolutely unique. Like I say, the forest and the ocean and the experience of partnering with tribal nations and communities, the rural location, the sense of community it's an absolutely incredible place to visit and for students to study, and that really small one-on-one experiences that students have with their faculty.
Yeah, well, given that, the university has had declining enrollment over the years. Some estimates were 30% under-enrolled. What have the challenges been?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges, frankly, has been that recognition or lack of recognition of the excellence here at this institution. I think we had a bit of a murky identity. And so this designation really clarifies for the prospective students what experience that they can have here and the degree that they can seek. And so what's really neat about this designation is it allows us, we've done some really intentional work to align with where the workforce gaps exist in the state of California, to really align with what students are expressing that they want and the degrees that they want, and things like cybersecurity and engineering and technology and data science. And then it has the added benefit of stimulating the North Coast economy, being the largest employer in the area.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the North Coast has many tribal nations, and you've indicated as part of this change that Indigenous wisdom will be respectfully and purposely reflected in the university's academic offerings. What does that look like?
Yeah, great question. So we aspire to be a different kind of polytechnic. And so in recognition of the excellence of the other two polytechnics in the system, we wanted to be a little bit different. And so part of that being different is incorporating Indigenous wisdom into our curriculum. So recognizing like we will launch an applied fire science and management degree, we'll launch a master's in engineering and environmental practice. So it's really taking that Indigenous wisdom that has known and has been in existence for many, many years and intentionally incorporating that into the curriculum alongside of traditional scientific inquiry so that our students are equipped with multiple ways of knowing to be able to best be in service of society, be scientists in service of society and solving community-based problems.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about something that's more than just rebranding. I mean, curriculum is also changing. When will students be able to see that change in curriculum?
So we are launching a jaw-dropping 8 new bachelor's programs starting in 2023, 1 new master's program and 3 new certificate programs in these specific areas of applied science, technology, and engineering. Students can enroll now in 2022. So that's my pitch for come to Cal Poly Humboldt. They can enroll now and start taking their general education courses and be ready to go in 2023.
When looking at some of the feedback that this designation has received, I mean, arts and humanities majors on campus have expressed some concern that this will result in less money for their departments. What is your response to that?
My response to that is that we are doubling down in our investment in liberal arts, humanities, and social sciences. We have a commitment to being a comprehensive university and a comprehensive polytechnic, and we can't serve the North Coast, the state of California, or our students if we are to deinvest in liberal arts, humanities, and social sciences. We need to produce graduates that are creative, who can communicate, who can work together as teams, who appreciate the arts, who can create art. And so we are very, very committed to that.
Okay, and financially committed.
Absolutely.
What about students that have graduated or maybe that are aspiring to go to what was Humboldt State and now are worried that the name change will impact tuition or even diploma validation? I mean, will there be tuition increases? And what does this mean for alumni and their diplomas?
Yes, certainly. So tuition increases, that is not anything. There are no tuition increases anticipated, and tuition isn't associated with a polytechnic designation. Tuition in the CSU system is determined at the system level, so there's no connection between this polytechnic designation and an increase in tuition. The Cal Poly Humboldt moniker on a degree or being able to claim that will actually seek to elevate our alumni and our future graduates, because there's a prestige associated with graduating from a polytechnic. So being able to claim that actually has significant value in their marketability.
You know, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and Cal Poly Pomona, they both have, you know, anywhere from 20 to 25,000 students. And Cal Poly Humboldt has several thousand, I believe 5,000 or 6,000. How does your university plan to compete with and convince prospective STEM students to head north for their polytech education?
Yeah, so what I would say is I don't think that our intention is to compete, but rather to collaborate. And so what one of the biggest values that we have as an institution is to create access. So to create access to education. And so being able to launch these new polytechnic programs, we're able to partner with Pomona and San Luis Obispo to create more access, particularly for first generation, lower income students and Black, Indigenous, people of color students as well. So to me, it's about how do we work together to create more access to education that will really support just positive things for the state of California.
What have you learned from San Luis Obispo and Pomona?
I think that we've learned that they have incredible rigor, that they've done an incredible job creating student support programs to support the success of their students. It's really important to us as an institution that we don't just create that access, but when we welcome in students, that we make sure that they are successful and they're wrapped up with all this the support that they can garner to successfully graduate and make an impact on the community.
Yeah, you touched upon this in the beginning that, you know, Humboldt is already serving a large number of STEM students in the CSU system. I believe the Board of Trustees said Humboldt is serving the third highest number of STEM students. The governor approved $458 million to help Cal Poly Humboldt with this transition. How will that money be used to essentially build on that already strong foundation?
Yeah, great question. So $433 million. One-time funding to support primarily infrastructure and technology. So in this region, this far north region of the state, there's need for additional housing, student housing. There's also need for additional academic buildings and spaces to support all of these academic programs that we're going to launch. The other piece is around technology, broadband, connectivity. That's something in this part of the state where probably other parts of the state don't experience as much connectivity issues as we do. So being able to invest in those pieces so that, again, students and faculty and staff have that access piece. So that $433 million in one time is really about infrastructure, buildings, housing. $25 million is in ongoing funding is to support the stand up of those 12 academic programs that I mentioned. So hiring faculty and staff and funding the student support services, being able to participate in marketing the institution and recruiting students. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Insight here on CAMP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Humboldt State, or Cal Poly Humboldt, about their new designation as a Cal Poly and what this change will mean to the campus and surrounding North Coast communities. You touched upon housing, and that brings me to Cal Poly Humboldt is in Arcata, a community of more than 18,000 people. Doubling the enrollment potentially will undoubtedly impact the housing in the surrounding communities. How is the university working with these communities to ensure that enough housing is being built for this anticipated influx of students and the people who will call these towns home?
Yeah, what we have done from the very beginning when we engaged in a self-study to even consider transitioning to a polytechnic is we engaged with our external partners. So the city of Arcata, and there's lots of small towns and communities in this area. So engaged with their leadership, went and met with any and every community group and really talked with them about the best way forward. And this the funding that we received really helped to support investment and planning around housing and infrastructure projects. The other thing I'd say is that we've also learned a lot about from the pandemic about how to teach successfully online. And so how do we have some of our programming be online? How do we have more robust summer session? Arcata is an amazingly beautiful and wonderful place to live, work, and study in the summertime. And historically, we haven't had as much activity over the summer. The other piece is how do we bring our education out to our neighboring communities, to our tribal nations? So all of our delivery of education doesn't have to exist just on campus. And so through those partnerships with city officials and thinking through the online education and summer session, I think those have been really well received.
Universities obviously have ripple effects in terms of economic activity and economic impact. How will Cal Poly Humboldt help economically the mostly rural North Coast communities? You're talking about Arcata and other neighboring communities in the North Coast.
Well, the first thing is that we are the largest employer in the area, so it's already creating a lot of opportunity for jobs just affiliated with the institution. But the fact that we've really been intentional about partnering and with external entities and figuring out where the workforce gaps are, where the needs are to help support and fill critical jobs and get folks trained up at our institution to then fill critical jobs in the area, what would happen a lot is that folks would have, job needs, but they wouldn't have people that were trained in those areas. And so as we partner and utilize sort of data-informed practices, this is huge. So, having a mechanical engineering program or an energy systems engineering program, marine biology program, students can graduate and then stay here and fill those critical workforce gaps. And then, in out years, so this is a phased plan. I mentioned 12 programs by 2023, but there's out year projections of additional programs by 2026 and 2029, really targeting things like programs in agriculture, dairy, healthcare, water, potentially aviation and aerospace. So, but again, continue to partner with our regional leaders to see what is going to be of best help. And so if we align with those needs, then it's really going to help the growth in the area.
Yeah. Finally, before we let you go, I mean, recruitment is a piece of this, that awareness. And your area is one of the most beautiful in the entire state. But it's also, well over a five-hour drive from both Sacramento and San Francisco. And there are a lot of other options out there. How will this funding or even this designation help with recruitment for future students, letting them know all that's available at Cal Poly Humboldt?
Yeah, we're really engaging in some pretty widespread marketing efforts to really get it out there, get our name and our brand out there, and getting folks to know that if you come to Cal Poly Humboldt, you can go out on the Coral Sea in a research vessel, that you can study at the Marine Lab, that you can be able to get out into the field and see the hundreds of different kinds of birds we have. But what I would say even more than the beauty of our location is the commitment of our faculty and our commitment to really defining our institution by who we include and not who we exclude. So really having a welcoming and warm campus that we are committed to the success of our students.
Dr. Capps, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Jen Capps is Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs at the newly named Cal Poly Humboldt, sharing with us what the name change means and how it will impact California's economic future and benefit North Coast communities. Still ahead, for those who know of morning pages, I personally have done them myself, or they just want to, you know, ignite your creativity, you'll enjoy Donna Apodoni's conversation with Julia Cameron, the author of The Artist's Way, about her latest book. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Julia Cameron, creator of The Artist's Way books and classes, has inspired generations of writers, artists, and other creatives over her decades-long career. I have buckled down for daily morning pages, which is stream of consciousness writing first thing in the morning to wake up your connection to creativity. This creative movement began about 30 years ago and since then has reached millions of people with dozens of best-selling books to reignite creativity from the arts to business and everyday life. Cameron has a new book with a different perspective on creativity. Morning Edition host Donna Apodoni talked with Julia Cameron and joins us with some highlights of their conversation. Donna, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I have had The Artist's Way, the book, for more than a decade now. How is this new book different from the others?
Well, you mentioned 30th book and the 30th anniversary of Artist's Way, so we have both of those things going for it. It's a book that explores a topic that Cameron feels is essential to her creativity. The book is called Seeking Wisdom, and it's about various forms of prayer, or as she calls it in this book, various forms of guidance.
Oh, so it's a spirituality aspect to this.
Yeah, it is.
You and I both have read The Artist's Way over and over again and went on our artist dates and morning pages and all that stuff. Julia Cameron developed that work as a way to be creative without substances, without alcohol specifically. Did she address that and talk about that as part of her background?
She did. She's always been very open in telling her sobriety story. And in this case, especially in this book, it has to do with a higher power.
My name is Julia. I think I'm an alcoholic and I'm a screenwriter. I was trying to hold on to some prestige, elusive prestige. And Edie came over and told me her story, and I identified, and that was the beginning of my sobriety. They told me, if you want to stay sober, you need to pray. And I said, prayer? I don't do prayer. And they said, well, you need to pray. You must believe in something. And I said, well, I believe in a line from Dylan Thomas, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. And I thought, I can pray to that creative energy. I say, don't let semantics be a bar for you. You don't need to call it God. You can call it the universe, the force, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You can call it whatever you need to call it, it will perform for you anyway.
I just realized I've never heard her voice before, Donna.
I know. Isn't that interesting? I hadn't heard her voice before either. In a way, she sounds like she's slowed down with age, but she hasn't. She's really sharp. But because she's a writer, she's always very carefully choosing her words, and she sort of self-edits as she talks.
Hmm. Part of The Artist's Way, and we touched upon this, involves morning pages, writing three pages, stream of conscious, first thing every day. I mean, this book has been around for 30 years, but how did she develop this?
Well, I really wanted to know how those morning pages work. She developed it as a way to be creative, as we said, without alcohol, but she counts on the morning pages. They add to creativity for her and for everybody who studies the book. I wanted to know so much how they work, so I was really surprised when she gave me her answer.
I don't know. I feel like I have years of practice with their being powerful, and I have seen them light up people's lives, light up people's faces. From the front of the room, if I'm teaching a big class for 12 weeks, I see that enlightenment is a literal term. I don't know why the pages work. I just know that the pages work. And my tools all come from practice, not from theory. So I don't have a theory to say, well, they work because. I just know that they do work and that they open doors for people. They give people a sense of expansion. They train people to take risks. They give encouragement. They bear witness to our lives. I have a friend who says, writing morning pages is like getting up in the morning and meeting your best friend.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I first started them, it was pretty uncomfortable because you're not supposed to let your pen or pencil leave the paper and nothing is wrong. And you're being intimate with yourself and really liking the parts of yourself that maybe you've like lodged deep inside of you. But I ended up loving morning pages because it's almost like opening the window to start your day and letting fresh air in.
Yeah, the process really grows on you. Like anything else, any other practice, you have to get used to it a little bit.
Well, and you got to get those juices flowing. We know that in the work that we do, but the artist way also includes time for fun.
Oh, a lot of fun is included in this. And the fun part is what Cameron calls the artist date.
All right, an artist date is a once a week solo expedition to do something that's fun or enchanting, something that tickles maybe your inner eight-year-old. It's an opportunity to expand your horizon. You go out and you do something for sheer fun. And again, if I'm teaching and I say, I have a tool for you, it's a nightmare. You have to wake up 45 minutes early and write. People will say, oh, I can do that. I know how to work on my creativity. But then if I say, now once a week, I want you to go out and play, people become skeptical. They fold their arms across their chest. They tilt their heads to one side. And they're like, play? I don't see what play has to do with creativity.
Right. And once again, this was uncomfortable at the beginning, too. And I realized through the process is that, you know, we don't play as much as we get older, but play does have everything to do with creativity. And it could be something as simple as going for a good walk or even a hike just to clear your head and open yourself up to being more creative.
Absolutely. I always feel much more creative after a walk or a hike. And Cameron actually includes walking as part of the process.
I believe we are led a footfall at a time. I believe that when we walk out, we may go out walking. I assign, take 2 20-minute walks a week, all by yourself, no cell phone, no puppy dog. Walking puts you in touch with your environment. It puts you in touch with a benevolent something. And I find that walking, it doesn't matter if you live in the country or you're in the city. If you just walk out and observe the environment, it opens an inner portal.
That is so true. When I go for a walk, just even in my neighborhood, and I leave my phone at home, I start noticing things about my neighborhood that I didn't notice before, and I've lived there for years.
Yeah, look, there's a tree, then it's blooming because it's spring. Look, those kids are playing in the park. Maybe they were there yesterday, too. Yeah, it's always ongoing, and you really get a fresh view of your immediate world and a little bit further out world as well.
Does Julia get some inspiration from other people?
She is such an extrovert. She always loves talking to other people. She has friends of all ages. Some are actors, some are writers, some are producers, all sorts of lines of creativity and artistry. And what I love is that she has regular conversations by phone. You know, we're always texting each other. We're always whatever. She actually calls people and gets together with people in a way that a lot of people don't. People are really drawn to her. So I had to ask what she looks for in other people. And she didn't hesitate with her answer.
I look for a creative spark. I respond to the sparkle that they have. I have a girlfriend, Laura Letty, who's been my friend for 30 years. And we pray together. And Laura was for 35 years a teacher of gifted kindergarten. And I found myself thinking, well, that's just about perfect for me. Little Julie, gifted kindergarten, a wonderful teacher. So I'm drawn to people's creative spark, and I find myself responding like a flower. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower. So as I contact that creative energy in someone else, I experience a blossoming myself. So it's sort of selfish.
I gotta ask, Donna, how did you become aware of the artist's way?
I became aware of the artist's way because I was teaching a class on purpose. That was the subject matter. It was about purpose. And I developed sort of a plan for how one might reach purpose. And people who were in the class said, oh, you based this on the artist's way, didn't you? And I hadn't. I had never even heard of it before. But I had to go out and get the book, and I found some similarities in that. And I love her work. It's different from what I was doing. But I love her work, and it really has inspired me the way it's inspired so many other people. How did you find it?
A friend recommended it to me. My friend is a writer, and I just wanted to get more in touch with my creativity, and they recommended The Artist's Way, and it was a lot of fun. I believe it was like a three-month kind of program, at least for me, and it really helped me build my confidence and feel comfortable with being creative, and it really applies to anyone. I mean, you don't have to, you know, be creative necessarily or an artist professionally. I mean, I think it's great to always stay in touch with that part of yourself. Given that you have read The Artist's Way, did you learn anything new, or what did you learn from Julia Cameron from talking to her that gives you a wider perspective about the artist's way?
A lot of it was in that answer that she gave when I said, why do the morning pages work? And she said, I don't know. It was very important to me, having taken the classes to study her work, it was very important to me that she reminded me in that very subtle way that all I have to do is know that the morning pages work. All I have to do is know that the process works. I don't have to know why. We never really know why. So she said it very subtly, but it stood out and it got my attention.
Yeah. And restlessness is a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I agree.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
That is Morning Edition host Donna Appadoni sharing her conversation with Julia Cameron, the author of The Artist's Way, about her latest book, Seeking Wisdom. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.